You are listening to an exclusive podcast on Money Control.
Hello and welcome to Digging Deeper with Money Control. There was more than a bit of noise since the start of 2019 that macroeconomic indicators indicated India's economy was slowing down. Not quite a doomsday scenario, but a serious cause for concern nevertheless, we were told by all sorts of experts. Even ex-RBI Governor Raghuram Rajan, Professor Rajan, the stuff of Shobha Day's dreams, strode across the election landscape in about April and May and started talking about the unhealthy state of affairs. Business News across the board lamented what they called a missed opportunity in 2014 for serious changes that would have helped economic growth. In fact, Mint reported that GDP numbers last October showed that the Indian economy was growing at 8.2% in the April to June quarter 1 year ago, the fastest quarterly growth in over 2 years. But that did not shield the government from criticism over its handling of the economy. The falling rupee, worsening current account deficit, stress in the banking sector, and a falling GDP, as Next reports went on to show, raised questions over the sustainability of the recent economic recovery. As it turned out, none of that, of course, deterred voters from installing Narendra Modi in the Prime Minister's office once again, because as we know, and as many studies have shown, Vikas and economic development was not what the voter voted for. They voted for entirely different reasons, but this is not that podcast. This podcast concentrates on what the wise men were talking about. Did the common people on the street simply did not care about the economy and voted for this government anyway, despite there not being any indicators that the economy was improving? Well, we're going to look at just those numbers, all these wise men who were talking about the macroeconomic indicators and what such parameters look like before Modi resigned, only to have a bigger swearing-in ceremony, of course. So this podcast, we're going to try and understand what these macroeconomic indicators are in the first place and how they're measured. And in subsequent episodes, we will discuss how the Modi years have done in terms of these parameters. That is the subject of today's Digging Deeper. What are macroeconomic indicators? My name is Rakesh Sharma and welcome to Money Control.
The Deep Dive podcast series.
What are macroeconomic indicators?
All right, then let's start things off. Let's start at the very beginning, because a beginning is a very good place to start. Let's get the definitions right first. What are macroeconomic indicators? Macroeconomics, according to trusty old Investopedia, is a branch of economics that studies the way the aggregate economy behaves. To quote the website, economy-wide phenomena are examined, such as inflation, price levels, rate of economic growth, national income, gross domestic product or GDP, and changes in unemployment. That's right, the rudimentaries that constitute an economy. To break that down into even simpler terms, macroeconomics looks at the overall big picture scenario of the economy and then analyzes how different sectors of the economy relate to one another to understand how the whole of the economy functions. This includes looking at variables like unemployment, GDP, and inflation. Macroeconomic models and the forecasts that they produce are used by many organizations, by government entities to aid in the construction and evaluation of economic policy, by businesses to set strategy in domestic and global markets, and by investors to predict and plan for movements in various asset markets. Microeconomics, on the other hand, looks at the behavior of individual actors in an economy, like people, you and me, households that we belong to, industries, etc. Now, these macro indicators can be anything the investor chooses, but specific pieces of data released by governments and non-profit organizations have become widely followed. The most up-to-date, regularly published report covers the latest statistics on GDP, inflation, agricultural production, employment, industrial production, savings, investments, core industries growth, export, import, government securities yield, monetary indicators, etc., 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 applicable to the economy. Of these, there are four important indicators that we will be talking about on this podcast. These are the terms that you keep hearing all the time in the media, and sometimes you feel like you know these terms and pretend like you know a lot about them, but let's face it, you don't, and that is precisely why this podcast will be concentrating on four important indicators: GDP, interest rate, consumer price index or CPI, and industrial production, that is IIP. So let's get into each one of those. Let's start with GDP. Let's examine gross domestic product first. In India, GDP is one of the most recognized economic indicators used by financial advisors, economists, research analysts, investors, traders, governments, etc., to trace recent economic developments. GDP, or gross domestic product, is one of the most important economic indicators to measure a country's economic health. It is the total economic production of the country, the face of the economy, as it were. When GDP value increases, it signals a strong or strengthening economy. However, it is one of the lagging indicators, meaning it tells us what has already happened, not what is going to happen. Many businesses adjust their payroll, expenditures, and inventory based on quarterly or annual GDP results. India's economy grew at 6.6% in 2017-2018 and, according to the World Bank, at 7.3% in FY19. Some remarkable improvement was seen in the April to July quarter of 2018-2019 in GDP, when it grew by an impressive 8.2%. So that's GDP for you, the face of the economy, or the total economic production of the country. Next up, interest rate. And you've been hearing a lot about interest rate today on the 6th of June, when the Monetary Policy Committee met and made its decision to cut repo rate by 25 basis points yet again. Decisions regarding interest rate and monetary policies are, of course, handled by the Reserve Bank of India. In case you've never followed financial news in India, you should know that it is considered a major economic event in India when the RBI decides interest rates for businesses, consumers, investors, and indeed India's economy. It is again one of the lagging indicators, which represents the money lent between banks. In India, monetary policies are determined by the imaginatively titled Monetary Policy Committee. Here's how that works. Consider this example, for example. When the Monetary Policy Committee increases interest rates, commercial banks or other lenders have to pay more interest to obtain money from the central bank, which they make up for by lending money to borrowers like you and me at higher rates. That makes it difficult for borrowers to take out loans. If the bank is charging me a lot of money as interest, I will be hesitant to make a withdrawal. As a result of this, borrowers or consumers, that is you and me, are less enthusiastic about taking loans, and businesses are discouraged from expanding their operations. As a result, GDP growth is affected. Conversely, if the interest rates are too low, not surprisingly, it results in increased demand for money, a rise in prices, and eventually inflation. Therefore, interest rates are rather crucial economic indicators which let us know about the economy and whether it is heating up or not. And it is also, as you might have guessed, a very tight rope walk. Next up, CPI. Not the party that was wiped out in the recent Lok Sabha elections. We will not have any communist jokes here, but let's get to all things capitalist. This is the Consumer Price Index, or what we know as inflation. Before CPI, WPI, or Wholesale Price Index, was one of the prime economic indicators used to measure inflation. India used this indicator for a very long time before adopting the Consumer Price Index to measure the rate of inflation. Why, you might ask, is CPI better? Why was the WPI ditched in favor of CPI? Well, it calculates inflation from the consumer's end, includes services which account for nearly 60% of the GDP, and accounts for rural as well as urban regions. It measures the change in prices of the total basket of goods and services, like transportation, medical care, and food over a period of time. That is why it is also known as the cost of living index. We already know the deal with inflation. Increasing inflation usually indicates a decrease in purchasing power for people. It has been observed repeatedly that the average standard of living declines with a rise in inflation. Inflation also influences job growth, GDP, and employment rates. On the other hand, high inflation results in high interest rates, which in turn encourages people to invest more and encourages financial institutions to provide loans to small firms and entrepreneurs. And finally, the parameter that we'll be talking about today is industrial production. Investors who have put their money in manufacturing, mining, gas, and utility sectors use the economic calendar for collecting reports on industrial production. In India, data on industrial production is put out every month. This data includes figures based on the raw volume of goods produced by factories, electric utilities, mines, etc. Industrial production is a key economic indicator which measures future inflation at the industrial level. Government authorities also keep an eye out for this data because it can indicate trends. And what is the drawback of this parameter? It only measures data for actual goods-producing industries and firms and not for services, because by definition, it's about production. So these are the four macroeconomic indicators that we rely on: GDP, interest rate, CPI, and industrial production. So with those definitions in mind, perhaps maybe you want to listen to them again in order to have a revision, because you know what? Practice makes perfect, and these are terms that might not necessarily be in our vocabulary on a daily basis, so there's no harm and no shame in listening to it one more time. Have you done it? Good. Now, let's focus on what's happening in India. India's fourth quarter GDP data was released on the 31st of May and showed the economy growing at 5.8% in the January to March period, which, by the way, is the slowest pace in 17 quarters. Another set of government data showed that India's infrastructure output grew 2.6% in April compared to last year. The government, meanwhile, has met the fiscal deficit target, that is 3.4% of the GDP for FY19, after sharply cutting spending towards the end of the financial year as revenue fell short of estimates. A couple of weeks ago, Mint reported that after showing some signs of improvement in March, their macro tracker indicated a deterioration in India's macro economy in April, thanks to a sharp slowdown in the consumer economy and a widening of the trade deficit. Slowing vehicle sales and weak air traffic growth suggest demand in the economy continues to be weak. Price signals reinforce this picture, Mint went on to claim. The slowing down of inflation is a bright spot in an otherwise fairly negative scenario, but it also signals weak purchasing power among the masses. Even as retail inflation remains benign, the underlying core inflation, excluding volatile items like food and fuel, which was trending above average till February, also eased in March and April. Mint claims low rural wage growth also points to weak demand conditions in rural India. That weak consumer sentiment seems to be crimping demand in the industrial sector. Rail freight traffic growth and core sector growth, which reflect growth in India's eight key infrastructure industries like power, coal, etc., are close to the red zone themselves and currently flashing amber. They're in yellow zone right now. While the Purchasing Managers Index, or PMI, for manufacturing still signals an expansion, the momentum is slowing down as the reading declined for three consecutive months to 51.8 in April, from 54.3 in February. So any number above 50 is good, any number less than 50 is bad, and we are teetering quite close to being less than 50. As of now, just about above 50. Media reports indicated that fiscal deficit targets will be revised upwards and the union government may lean more on stimulating the economy and less on consolidating its finances. While this could boost consumption demand and have ripple effects on industrial demand, such a choice is fraught with risks and could also undo hard-won gains in the fight against inflation and burgeoning public debt. It could also make India more vulnerable to external shocks. And that happens to be the state of affairs in May and June 2019, when we not only have the repeat of the old administration in Modi 2.0, but also a new finance minister in the form of Nirmala Sitharaman. The Modi administration has come back with a thumping majority, but it does not mean we should not take a look back at what the data look like for the last 5 years. What was the promise of the Modi government the first time around when they came in 2014? You've given 60 years to the Congress. Give us 60 months and we'll show you how it's done. So, for now, let's take a look at what happened between 2014 and 2019. Obviously, in the coming few episodes of this, I'll be talking in greater detail about what happened. Were the promises met? Why is unemployment at a 45-year high? And are the common man's dreams and aspirations from the Modi government met? And why is there still so much difficulty in finding jobs, especially for women in rural areas? All of these questions will be answered in the coming few episodes, but let's take a look at what the Modi government has done in the past 5 years. Business journalist Vivek Kaul wrote that the quality of India's economic data in general and GDP data in particular have come in for questioning in recent months. Those questions acquired more urgency in January, when the GDP growth in 2016-2017 was revised to 8.2% which is the highest in any year between 2011-12 and 2018-2019. He claimed that in FY17, a large section of the informal economy, which forms a significant portion of India's economy, was severely hit by demonetization. So, how did the economy grow at a whopping 8.2%? Now, these are the sort of numbers you will not see in developing countries. If America grows at a rate of 3%, they are shocked. India, being one of the most rapidly developing economies in the world, can still lay claim to rates of 8.2%, etc. But even in the face of all of this gross unemployment going on and demonetization and how it hit the informal sector, the number of 8.2% is massive. Just how did that happen? You, of course, probably recall the ruckus from January 2015 when the government recalibrated its GDP growth series data. Based on this, the Ministry of Statistics and Program Implementation revised past GDP numbers, and the data, thus revised, revealed that the growth during the UPA years averaged about 8.1%, higher than the 7.3% in the first 4 years of the NDA government. That sparked more than one political debate, as you might recall, and the ministry later added a caveat saying that the data wasn't final. They were also, of course, challenging the fact that the UPA government had shown double-digit growth in their term. Then, in November, the government think tank, Niti Aayog, and CSO, that is the Central Statistics Office, which is India's Central Statistics Office, downgraded growth during the UPA years. The first 4 years of Modi showed higher average growth of 7.4% than during the UPA's 6.7%. The Modi government disregarded the August numbers as experimental, sparking opposition fury that questioned the sanctity of these numbers. Numbers that have been questioned ever since, and some would say with reason. In any case, indications are that lower consumer spending, sluggish investments, and slower growth in agriculture and manufacturing are adversely affecting growth. Sure, there were blips. It had to give its initial fiscal deficit target of 3.3% for the last financial year a miss. In the interim budget presented earlier this year, that number was revised to 3.4%. But economists are not very sure even this target will be met, and some have voiced concerns it may stay put at the current 3.5% levels. The government achieved the current fiscal deficit thanks to the 28,000 crore rupees that the RBI transferred as interim dividend for FY19. That move wasn't received happily at all by economists. Convenience much, opposition parties accused the government of accounting jugglery to meet disinvestment targets and keep fiscal deficit under check. One economist with a rating agency told Quartz, and I quote, "There have been farm loan waivers, populist measures in the budget, and a shortfall in revenue, and still fiscal deficit is under check. This is a wonder, and just forces one to think, how is the government actually managing to do it? Just how does she do it? Maybe she's born with it. Maybe it's Maybelline, or maybe it's Modi magic. Who knows?" That said, one wonders if that isn't true of most governments in India's history, but somewhat extremely conspicuous in the recent one. What about the much-touted investments? They keep saying that foreign investment is back, etc., etc. Let's take a look at what's happening in that front. A report on Quartz claimed that an important reason for faltering GDP growth is the somber investment environment. According to CMIE, that is the Center for Monitoring Indian Economy, a think tank that tracks economic data, investments into new projects in the quarter ended December 31st, 2018, stood at their lowest level since Modi took charge. That is a far cry from the BJP's promise of bringing in fresh investment and kickstarting stalled projects to spur growth, make in India, digital India, etc., etc. Between October and December 2018, that is last year, the value of stalled projects shot up to 3.18 lakh crore rupees, which is the second highest in the Modi government's tenure, that is Modi 1.0, which brings us to a flagship program of the Modi government, Make in India. While it made for a nice slogan, it had a decidedly underwhelming outcome for the first 4 years. Frankly speaking, it showcases the failure of the government to implement its Make in India program, which aimed to make the country a manufacturing hub and spur investments. Did it actually happen? According to most people, not really. Abhik Barua, who is the chief economist of HDFC Bank, said, and I quote, "It started off with a lot of fanfare, but has not managed to take things off the ground. We don't seem to have a comprehensible plan for local production of goods or services." Unquote. Now, moving on in the list of economic indicators, we come to one that's close to our hearts and wallets: inflation. As I said earlier, slowing rural growth, softening international commodity prices, and erratic monsoons have taken a toll on Indian farmers in certain regions. Some media reports claim farm income has slumped to a 14-year low and that non-farm wage growth has slowed down, painting an even bleaker picture of the state of the rural economy. The opposition attempted to make farm distress an election issue, and very rightly so, but failed to communicate their point of view properly. That's probably because the Modi government managed to somehow miraculously keep inflation in check. Devendra Kumar Pandit, who is the chief economist at India Ratings, went on to say it is an achievement of the current government as prices of essential items have not shot through the roof. And that is true. How the government has managed to do this, I do not know, but that is the fact. The economy, especially in the rural parts of the country, have been seeing some dire days. And yet, we do not see the prices of essential items shooting through the roof. That said, employment. This is where crisis is. One side claims an unemployment crisis has exploded across India. The other side says, what crisis? Glancing back at Modi's campaign in 2013-2014, one of his main promises was adding 10 million new jobs if voted to office. And 5 years later, it's safe to say that's not quite what has happened. According to a government survey cited by Business Standard a few months ago, unemployment had risen to a 45-year high of 6.1% in 2017-2018. The government initially tried to say those were not accurate numbers, that it was leaked and it was not proofed, and then eventually, after the swearing in, etc. has happened, have come to say, well, you know what, those numbers are actually right. Now, that number, 6.1% unemployment, the highest in 45 years, is a matter of serious concern, because as a country, we are expected to add over 280 million people to the job market by 2050. That's not too far away. That's about 30 years away from now. 280 million new people will be added to the job market. A World Bank report recently pointed out that India needs to create over 8 million jobs per year to maintain its current employment rate. 8 million jobs a year. And Modi had said he would create 10 million jobs a year, and that has simply not happened. But it's not all doom and gloom for the India story. There are some terrifying numbers, I agree, but it's not all doom and gloom. While serious concerns have been expressed and are expected to be addressed in Modi 2.0, here is hoping, it is also true that major financial institutions and trade organizations have expressed confidence in India's growth trajectory. In March, Moody's announced that the Indian economy is expected to grow at a fairly healthy 7.3% in calendar year 2019 and 2020. The American rating agency, that is Moody's, said India is less exposed to a slowdown in global manufacturing trade growth compared to other major Asian economies and emerging markets, and is poised to grow at a relatively stable pace in the next 2 years. It also went on to add that the government spending announced ahead of elections this year will support near-term growth. David Solomon, who is the CEO of Goldman Sachs, said only a few days ago, and I quote, if the reform program accelerates, there can be considerable upside in the GDP growth on a forward basis. Our growth will closely match that of the growth of the Indian economy. Our base case on GDP growth is 7.5%, unquote. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, more commonly known as OECD, not OECD, OECD, said in its economic outlook in May, and I quote, GDP growth in India is projected to strengthen to close to 7.25% in FY19 and close to 7.5% in FY20, unquote. The Economic Times reported that OECD highlighted India as the fastest growing economy among the G20, with export growth holding up well. It said investment growth will accelerate as capacity utilization rises, interest rates decline, and geopolitical tensions and political uncertainty are assumed to wane, unquote. But you do know of recent reports which put China ahead of India as the fastest growing economy in the world. How that will change over the course of the next few years is for anyone to guess. But I have been reading another book called The Great Disappointment by Salman Anis Sos. And I would like to read a few passages, a few questions that he poses when you come back.
The Deep Dive podcast series. What are macroeconomic indicators?
Okay, now you've come back. And I said I was reading a book. It's called The Great Disappointment. This is, of course, a book by Salman Anis Sos. It talks about how Narendra Modi squandered a unique opportunity to transform the Indian economy. In the book, in the very first few pages of the book, he poses a few questions. Has the Modi government been able to deliver on its campaign's economic narrative, one that promised a conservative minimum government stance? Has the Modi government promoted the next generation of reforms that the previous government was unable to pursue? Have macroeconomic policies led to the promised spurt in growth and job creation? Has the investment scenario significantly improved compared to that under the previous economic regime? Have agricultural development and the rural-urban transition happened in a fundamentally different way than past experience? And has the Modi government focused adequately on human development policies that can help young people become productive members of society? These are all questions that you've asked yourself, albeit not in those terms, because, you know, you don't have a degree in economics, and neither do I. But those are, anyway, important questions. And those will also be the questions that we will be addressing and hopefully answering in the coming few episodes. So, hopefully this primer of a course on what macroeconomic indicators are and where we find ourselves at this moment in time is enough of a lesson for you to get into that next chapter in this series, where we will examine whether or not Narendra Modi has been a great disappointment. In the meanwhile, do write into us, mcpodcast@nw18.com. I love hearing what you have to say. Bouquets, brickbats, whatever, send them, keep them coming. You can also leave us a comment on whatever platform you're listening to these podcasts on. Until the next time you hear from me, this is me, Rakesh Sharma, on behalf of the Money Control Podcast Desk, saying thank you for joining us, and do stay with us on moneycontrol.com to be a smart listener and an even smarter investor.
This has been a Digging Deeper podcast, and you have been listening to Money Control.